This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad. And the Ontario Legislature, as you heard in Jeremy's news, is back in session and a budget is coming down on Thursday. It is expected to be an austerity budget. So what does that mean for older Ontarians in the midst of this affordability crisis? And we've been talking about the imminent move to shield the Premier and the Cabinet from freedom of information. So far, though, the Progressive Conservatives' first move has been for legislation that will allow for the expropriation of the city's portion of the Billy Bishop Airport. We knew that was going to happen, did not know it was going to be at the very top of the agenda. Would like to know what you think of that. And all of last week, the Premier engaged in these, what I call, flights of Fordisms. And it seems to me that the unifying theme, if there was one, was appealing to people who don't feel safe in their communities and their homes. And I think that will be his edge when it comes to crafting together another majority government, he hopes, though there's no sign of any provincial election anytime soon, aside from a by-election. So, the numbers, 866-744-740, that is the text line, the long-distance phone line, the local phone, 416-360-0740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, David Valentin, principal at Liaison Strategies, and Rob Davis, a former Toronto City Councillor. Hi, everyone.
Good afternoon, Libby.
Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Libby.
So let's begin with David. So his first order of business is the legislation that will allow for the expropriation of the land for Billy Bishop. Is that something that has really been on people's minds, David, or is it not?
Well, it's not. And it's part of this long string of announcements, as you mentioned, of things maybe he'll do, maybe he won't do. Some things he'll allow, like, you know, Ontarians can now bring their own beer to select events. But those events, before you get too excited, have to be pre-selected, have to be predetermined. You won't just be able to do this for whatever event you might want to go to. They have to apply and be approved. So we have that whole process in place. I think you're seeing a government that is trying to do a lot of things to draw attention to some of the problems that people are facing. The Premier was asked about healthcare, and his remark was, well, what we actually have to do is buy more advertisements about how well things are going in healthcare. I think most people
buy them
in Ontario
with us
receiving healthcare would rather, yeah, buy them here. But,
buy them
but also,
here.
You know, I think most people would say they'd rather have that money go into the healthcare system. Sorry, Libby. Maybe it might be fewer ads, but his point is actually we should just tell people it's getting better. And regardless of whether it is or it isn't, it would be better if people thought it was. So that's an interesting place to start. But the poll numbers for them are not that there's any election anytime soon, are getting softer and softer. You saw Ipsos, one of our competitors on Friday, putting it at a 7-point lead for the Conservatives. We added at a 4-point lead end of February. So, you know, between 4 and 7, not a lot of difference, but that's where things are right now.
And, you know, there is one by-election coming up after the presumably after the federal by-elections, because the MPP and deputy leader of the Ontario NDP jumped ship and is running for the Liberals federally. So Nate Erskine Smith is going to be running in Scarborough Southwest, and he is a hopeful to lead the leaderless Liberals. And Ford was trashing him, said, you know, if that guy was sitting in front of me in a room, I wouldn't recognize him.
That might, excuse me, Libby, that might be true, but I think Doug Ford and the Conservatives are, you're a tennis player, have a lot of unforced errors in the recent weeks. So waiting 14 weeks between sessions, that's not what Ontarians are experiencing in their daily lives. So, you know, they're not in Parliament. They're not being seen to be doing the work of the government. So I think that's a strike against them. And then this transparency on the freedom of information, that sits poorly, I think, with the general public, saying, what are you hiding if you are insisting that the media can't get access to your records? The cuts to OSAP is a misfire again, giving fuel to the NDP and the Liberals if they ever get a leader. And then the overreach on the governance of the school boards. So that's another issue where parents and families who tend not to pay attention to school boards until they're threatened with being taken away. Again, I think all these things are building up a case for opposition to really make a charge against the Conservatives whenever there is an election.
Well, I have to say, on the issue of school boards, as a counterbalance, there are a lot of people who think that there's a lot of nonsense going on.
Sure, but you don't fix the weak governance by eliminating it.
Well,
you fix the governance.
It depends on who you speak to. So I think they're probably even on the, at least even. I speak to a lot of people who say, you go. By taking over school boards that have very mixed messages. Rob, what do you think? I mean, Anthony also mentioned the public is not happy with the imminent strictness, like, prevention
the potential austerity plan.
No, I want to first tackle freedom of information. So
let's talk about that. I mean, I have some sympathy for the government. I have, you know, a Facebook account where somebody might send me a message. I have an email account. I have text messaging. They might send me a private message on Instagram. They might send me a private message on WhatsApp. I think when you're a person in politics and if you're a minister of the crown, you might have people coming at you from a social as well as a professional perspective, coming at you all of the time through the various means that they can communicate to you. So I understand that the complexity of communications and social media makes it difficult. But let's be clear, anybody who's a lobbyist by law has to register that contact with the minister. So a lot of these things are already in the public realm. So if a developer, if a business person, somebody who wants to get a policy change, wants to lobby the government of the day, they have to register themselves as a lobbyist. They have to register the issue that they're lobbying on, and they have to register the targets of the lobbying. A lot of this is already known. Now, provided they abide by the law and obey the rules, they're going to do that. Obviously, the FOI is sort of a check or a counterbalance against lobbyists perhaps not using the proper channels in order to make contact with the government. But in this day and age, when every politician is on social media, you don't control who sends you a message and who, you know, talks to you or tries to influence you at a cocktail party. That being said, I think there may be a middle ground that they could reach with respect to what they're doing. And maybe eliminating all of the communications as being privileged and not being subject to FOI might be a bridge too far. But certainly, you know, every single, you know, Facebook message that you get, I mean, imagine as a minister, you have to go back a year or two and look at every single person who's ever contacted you and try to figure this out. It's expensive and it causes a lot of undue waste in terms of just in terms of effort and resources.
Just one quick thing, if I may, you know, at the City of Toronto and at the federal level, if you're a lobbyist and you meet with a minister or somebody, you have to register the meeting. At the provincial level, that doesn't exist. You register once and say, I'm going to lobby the government and here's who I'm going to talk to. In broad terms, the ministries,
Right.
But you have no way of knowing who got meetings, who met with whom, on which dates. That doesn't exist at the provincial level. It does municipally, it does federally.
Right.
And the other thing I'll just point out quickly, you know, when we talk about Facebook messages or Instagram messages, what they're talking about for the specifics of this legislation is shielding all of the government emails. So I don't think people care if someone sends the Premier of Ontario a Facebook message. I think what they're looking at is the email correspondence. A lot of the cases that Freedom of Information Commissioner has already found, they're not even using their government emails. They're using their personal emails to do government work, to try to avoid the rules that way. So I don't think the solution to that is to just get rid of the rules altogether. I think they should probably follow the rules that are in place today, use their work emails for the stuff. And, you know, if it's a cabinet confidence or something like that, it doesn't get released anyway. We're talking about communications that show wrongdoing, whether it's about things like the Science Center or even things maybe now. There's emails about the airport we don't know about that should be disclosed. We're not going to see those things anymore. So that's what we're talking about. And this whole idea we're going to match the federal disclosure isn't quite correct, because they're not going to disclose their lobbying meetings with this new legislation.
Let me just, David, I hope that Anthony is right and that people care about this. But in your view, do people care about this?
Well, that's a good question. And we're going to find out this weekend. This weekend, we're doing a new survey of Ontario, and we're going to find out if people care about freedom of information. So we'll have an answer soon.
Yeah. And what about this blooming skills development scandal? I mean, one of the things that we try to find out with freedom of information is, why was a certain decision made, right? So we don't know that. I mean, the opposition says that friends of the Ford government got contracts, even though civil service people said those proposals weren't good. So we'd like to know what happened.
It's terrific that the premier and his brother before him gave out their personal phone number so that the citizens feel that they can have access to their leader. And that is an amazing form of access to government.
I thought he pulled it. Well, he stopped taking my calls.
But when you're using that personal cell phone for government business that you want to have off the record, that's when it's a concern. And that's when we expect the reporters and the media to be digging into this on behalf of the voters and the citizens. So to just cut that off, I think that is, you know, I think media should be in an uproar. And if they still have a voice and an audience in Ontario, that will play with the voters, I believe, and give more fuel to the NDP and maybe the Liberals.
Rob, I mean, is there any other way that we'll find out about stuff like that?
Well, listen, if a government wants to do things in a nefarious manner, it doesn't matter what the FLI rules are. It doesn't matter what the lobbying rules are. They'll be able to work around it. The point I'm trying to make is I have some empathy for and some sympathy for the fact that there are so many different channels by which a lobbyist, a business person, can contact a minister and start communicating. I empathize. And my suggestion is using the lobbyist registry and tightening the lobbyist rules should be or could be the path to providing the right amount of oversight that the media and members of the public want to have, and at the same time allow ministers to get on with the job of governing. And I think that's really vitally important.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Ford keeps saying is that people leave very personal messages on his voicemail. Okay. And Rob was just talking about social media. I mean, come on. Do you as a person or any citizen really think that you have privacy when you just leave a message on someone's voicemail or certainly on social media? Come on.
Well, the rules say right now that if you leave a voicemail with identifying information, with personal information, it doesn't get disclosed. So the situation they're trying to tell us about, you know, someone leaves personal information, that isn't going to get disclosed anyway. They're not talking about publishing everything and no one is reviewing it. There is someone reviewing it to make sure it's relevant to government business. Listen, if the premier had his work phone and took calls on his work cell phone, then we wouldn't need to ask for the personal cell phone records. That is what Global News has been doing. They're asking for those records because the premier does not use his work cell phone. So we're paying for him to have a work phone. He just doesn't want to use it. It all goes on his personal. And unfortunately, the situation that we're in now is they're changing the rules because they lost a court case where the court said, yeah, someone is going to have to review your personal phone record. They're not going to publish the personal calls, but they are going to publish the call records for the work calls. And so this was apparently too much. And so they said, you know what we'll do is we'll just rewrite the rules. And unfortunately, we see this a lot from the Ford government, which is that organizations take them to court. They lose the court battle. So they say, you know what we'll do? We'll just pass a retroactive law so that we can get away with the conduct we have already committed. It's very frustrating for people who are suing the government because as soon as you win, they just change the law.
Yeah. And in a very short session, I might add, I'm going to read a text from Steve in Brampton. And he writes, still wrapping my head around this freedom of information, but generally I'm suspicious of anything that impairs transparency. Not good optics. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the sense is that there's this centralization of power going on at Queen's Park. It's been happening, but when you've got the education file, the municipalities, and just policies, policy and policy and policy, all being centralized into Queen's Park, and a small group of the cabinet ministers, or even the premier himself, making all of the decisions for Ontarians, that's that sense that we may be giving up too much of our democratic power for that entire period between elections.
But we don't have power, Anthony. The cities are creatures of the province, and the school board thing, the province would be well within its purview to, you know, get rid of school boards, and they're 100 years old. So, and frankly, we see that tendency at the federal level with Liberals. It's not just a conservative thing, they the more power they have, the more they want, David.
That's right. And listen, I think we should be aware that there's lots of things the federal government should do to make information easier to come out of. If its ministries has a very long wait list for people who are filing freedom of information requests, they should put more resources to speeding that up. But that being said, you know, we should be wanting governments to be more transparent. The solution is not to try to make people less transparent to match some fictional context about the government of Canada. Now, speaking about the federal government very quickly, the premier is making all of these announcements, special economic zone for the city of Toronto's Island Airport. But that airport is governed by, or was governed by, a tripartite agreement. Province is taking over the municipal part of the agreement. What Doug Ford isn't saying is he actually needs the federal government to sign off and approve on all of the things that he wants to do for the Island Airport in order for them to go ahead. So I think we're seeing, you know, will they go along with this plan? I don't know. But before anyone gets too upset or too excited about what might take place at the Island Airport, understand it's a big part of federal jurisdiction. That airport is one of the few airports in Canada that does not have an independent airport authority. There's all sorts of things you might want to fix with that relationship before you start trying to put shovels in the ground and accusing the city of Toronto of building towers to sabotage imaginary runways. He needs the federal government to sign off on all of this first.
Oh, yeah, and it may impact the by-elections that are about to occur in Toronto as well.
Well, I think we've certainly covered that here, and I think the federal government has said it's open.
The special economic zone, when I heard about it first, it made a lot of sense to me. I'm thinking we've been waiting too long to get into the Ring of Fire. We have to get the minerals out of the ground. We have to stop with decades-long environmental evaluations, and Canada, Ontario needs these economic drivers in our economy. I wasn't thinking about more business jets flying out of Pearson as a special economic reason to abandon existing laws.
Okay, let's move along in our last bit to this austerity budget. The expert predictions I'm reading is that they're going to put a lot of money in reserves. The economy is not getting better. It is getting worse. There was some relief for people who are affected by tariffs last time. And their predictions for when the budget will get into balance are going to be out the window. So what, Anthony, are you worried about in this budget?
The health care is the biggest concern for CARP and for myself. The funding increases that they've been making and the announcements they've been making over the last many years have sounded terrific, but they barely keep up with inflation, and they don't take into account the swelling demand for healthcare resources with the boomers. So these billions of dollars for long-term care, billions of dollars for home care, all great announcements, but really not enough to keep up with the inflationary demand, never mind the increasing human demand.
David?
I think one interesting thing will be to see what economic conditions they are expecting for the rest of the year. Of course, the price of oil is up quite a lot right now. Could go higher, could go lower, depending on what happens in this whole situation in Iran. And there's spillover effects that are going to affect municipalities as the cost of diesel goes up, as the cost of different supplies go up. Hospitals are going to be facing shortages too. Some of the chemical compounds that they require are influenced by this conflict as well. So seeing if there's any relief, additional measures to increase flexibility for hospitals, any concrete plan to ensure emergency rooms are not closing in the province this year, those are all the things I'm paying attention to. But I think, unfortunately, we're going to see not enough investment, as Anthony is saying. And, you know, we're in a very difficult situation where if we're not making investments now, we are going to be paying the price, seriously paying the price, in 5, 10, 15 years. And that goes to whether, you know, it's an education issue when you look at the issue of class sizes right now, where in a lot of cases, they're not even counting how many kids are in a class anymore because they don't want to publish those statistics. And now they're not collecting the data on hallway healthcare, right? So we won't know if the problem is getting any better or, as most people suspect, is getting worse. So these are, it's troubling when we're not collecting the data, not just because, you know, we don't get to see it on a fun graph, but because there's real world policy implications for people who get show up to that hospital emergency room and find out it's closed. They've got to travel another hour, 2 hours to get urgent care. You don't want to see people in that situation.
Didn't he get elected on a promise to end hallway health care? Wasn't that how he got elected the first time?
I'll jump in here.
Yeah.
There was CBC, I think it was CBC, had a skit out last week. And there's a hit show called The Pit, which is an ER in Pittsburgh.
Oh, I love that show.
So they did, I think it was, this hour has 22 minutes. They called it The Peg instead of The Pit. And the doctor's walking around writing referrals. That's all he can do is write referrals to the patients who have had a car crash or having a heart attack. And said, we need more hallway. We need more hallway. That's the joke. They're not looking for more hospital beds or more. They just need more hallway to meet the demand. And that was a great skit. And when the satire is actually reaching down into the things that people are experiencing every day, I think that tells us that the problem is nationwide and everyone's experiencing it in the ERs.
Rob?
Well, listen, like David, I'm interested to see what the economic conditions are that they predict are going to happen. I mean, the war in the Middle East has been is causing headwinds to the economy. The unemployment numbers in February, Canada-wide, were that there were 92,000, I believe, jobs lost. And so the question will be, does the finance minister predict a slowing in the economy? How much of a slowing in the economy? And how much has the war in Iran, the Iranian war, affected this budget? I mean, they were in the middle of cobbling this budget together when the war broke out. Budgets are not things that you put together at the last minute. There's a long and involved process in terms of measuring economic output, the GDP, as well as opportunities that might exist in the marketplace for the government to either, you know, put their hand on the scale, whether it's Ring of Fire. So I'm going to be interested to see how much Minister Bethenfalvy has accommodated for the war in Iran. That'll be telling as to whether they believe it's going to be a long and involved conflict or whether they believe it's going to be simply sort of a blip on the screen and that it won't affect the long-term economic prospects of the province of Ontario.
Well, and as to the price of gas, the price of oil, which spiked up, it went way down today based on what Trump said. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard is denying what he said. So who knows?
Well, Ontario cut their provincial tax on oil and gas, sorry, on gasoline. So we're not getting the increased revenue when it goes up provincially. But I think the U.S. trade war is much more relevant to the Ontario budget than the war in Iran right now because of the auto sector and those industries that are suffering because of this this pushback from Donald Trump. And that's going to affect the economy in this budget more than the war, I believe.
Well, yeah, I think almost more to the point is what is in the budget to shield us against the prospect that we don't get another trade deal, which we desperately need. David?
Well, it'll be really hard for them to do that because they haven't left themselves a lot of fiscal capacity. So we're going to have to see what they have. I worry that there's not really going to be that many more expanded measures and that they're planning to wind some of these programs down. So it'll really depend on what the government has prioritized. Again, you know, right now they're budgeting still for the highway tunnel, right? That's still on the books in terms of things that they have allocated money towards. Now, I don't really know if that's going to go ahead or not, but when you're throwing money at studies for projects like that, as opposed to funding healthcare, funding education, funding job support measures so we can keep jobs in the province, you know, you make the math really tough for yourself in finding ways to help workers who are really badly affected.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. By the time we talk again, we'll actually know what was in that budget. And I'm sure we will have some interesting thoughts on that. In the meantime, thank you so much, Rob Davids, Dave Valentin, and Anthony Quinn.
Thanks, Libby.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby.
Bye.
Okay, we're taking a break. When we come back, we will talk about that terrible plane crash at LaGuardia Airport, the death of two Air Canada pilots. We'll have some details on that when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it is a terrible tragedy on what many consider to be a short routine flight. Two pilots have died after an Air Canada Express plane from Montreal collided with a fire truck at LaGuardia Airport in New York City shortly before midnight last night. And Air Canada Express CRJ-900, that's the plane, was operated by Jazz, which is its partner. It was carrying 72 passengers and four crew members. 41 passengers and crew were taken to hospital. 9 remain there as of the time I picked up this alert. Air traffic audio indicates that the fire truck was cleared to cross the runway before the collision. And the words, "I messed up," you could hear a controller saying that afterwards. So what does that mean? I am now joined by John Graddock, a faculty lecturer in the Aviation Management Program at McGill University and a former Air Canada executive, and John Cox, CEO of Safety Operating Systems and a former airline pilot based in Washington, D.C. Okay, yes, we're having a little technical difficulty with John Cox. But let's begin with John Graddock. What are your initial thoughts on this?
Oh, this was a tragedy. This should not have happened. This is not something you expect to have in a commercial operation between Canada and the U.S., especially in New York. Air Canada flies multiple times a day into LaGuardia. So this is not something that Air Canada has experienced. I think the industry, the last time we had such an event was about a year and a half ago, when we had Japanese Coast Guard airplane misaligned on a runway, and based on instructions from air traffic control, and it collided with an arriving Japan Airlines fleet. So these situations are very, very rare. They don't happen. We don't want to see these things happen, and the controllers are responsible for the movement of airplanes onto the runway and for rolling rolling traffic, rolling equipment to be accessing only those parts of the runways that are authorized to clear. So this fire truck was in fact responding to another incident on a landing aircraft, which happened about a couple of minutes earlier. And there was a United Airlines plane that was detecting smoke in the cabin on arrival. And this truck was rushing to that aircraft, had to cross runway 4, which was the active runway, and air traffic control gave him authority to cross runway 4. And then immediately noticed that the runway 4 was being used by an arriving Air Canada flight, CRJ, and told the truck to stop, but it was too late. And the truck was in the middle of the runway when the aircraft rolled by. And it was a collision that resulted in the crumpling of the front end of the airplane and the death of pilot angle.
So we've heard the traffic controller too late trying to tell the fire truck to stop. We've heard the words, "I messed up." Is it pretty clear, John, that this issue can be laid at the feet of the air traffic controller?
Well, not really. My voice recognition technology is in my ears. My eardrums are not attuned enough to be able to identify who spoke those words. So I'm going to leave that to the investigators. Both the NTSB and the TSB have got investigators on site, and they're going to be looking at the voice cockpit orders as well as Petery.
Okay, I'd like to bring in John Cox, CEO of Safety Operating Systems and a former airline pilot. What's your initial reaction to this?
I think the first questions that the investigators are going to ask is, who knew what and when did they know it? So they're going to listen to the cockpit voice recorder. They will interview the air traffic controller. And when a fire crew is medically able, they'll interview them, so that they build a timeline of how this tragedy unfolded and who knew what and when did they know it.
Uh-huh. As lay people, we've heard audio of air traffic telling the fire truck to stop. We've also heard a little snippet of audio, "I messed up," from a controller, presumably John Cox. What do you make of those things?
Until we know definitively who said what and there is a transcript of those transmissions, which there will be in pretty short order, I'm hesitant to draw any conclusions. Certainly, those are questions that will be asked and answered. But as it stands today, to try to draw any conclusions there, it's premature.
Mm-hmm. Now, John Graddick, these events are obviously very rare. There's been some chaos in the States, this time not with air traffic controllers. But do you think that may have played into this?
I don't think there's a direct correlation between what happened last night and the general chaos that you'd say is happening. I think that we know that there's a shortage of air traffic controllers in the States, somewhere around 3,000. The FAA is, in fact, putting out an accelerated pace to bring more controllers into the fold. It's going to take years to bring those controllers up to their regular levels of staffing. In the meantime, newly minted controllers are being asked to work, extended shifts, double shifts, work mandatory overtime. So, one of the questions you're going to be asked, the investigators are going to be asking, is really the rest cycle for the controller that was controlling, the intersection of that taxiway and runway 4. What shift was he on? How long did he be on the job? How many hours did he be on the job? What was his sleep patterns over the last 4 or 5 days? All to get the psychometric and the basically this, you know, the awareness that's required of a controller. These jobs are requiring individuals to be on the ball second by second. They have split the second decisions that they're making, and they have, you cannot allow situations to get into a way where the decisions are not being done with due regard to where the situational awareness requires them to be. And I think that, you know, this is going to be a key element of the investigation.
John Cox, what's your take on that?
They will look very carefully at the work schedule of the controller. They will interview his family and himself as far as the potential for fatigue. Did that play any part of it? They will interview any other controllers that may have been on a similar work schedule or in the tower cab at the same time. They will assemble a profile of the individuals involved, and that will be part of the human factors component of this investigation.
Is it, you know, bottom line for now, a terrible tragedy? Is it, are you seeing this as just some kind of very unusual, almost freak accident, or again, something that has to have a very complicated remedy?
Well, if you ask me, John, just for a sec, it really is, you know, is this a systemic problem? Like, we've known about this air traffic controller issue for years. And we've seen incidents at airports where we have, you know, wingtip collisions between aircraft. And, you know, do we really blame the pilots? We blame ground crew? Do we blame ground controllers? There's been an uptick in terms of ground incidents at U.S. airports over the last 12 to 18 months. And is that a function of lack of controllers or lack of skilled controllers? I don't know the answer to that. So as soon as we get the information on this one, I think that will cause some questions to be asked of a lot of the administrators at the FAA in terms of the type of shifts and the type of training these guys get. And that should help us try to figure out what the next steps ought to be.
John Cox, last word on this to you.
I think we need to understand that these ground collisions like this with fatalities involved are very rare. There was one in 1991 in Los Angeles. There was one some years ago where a LATAM Airbus struck a fire truck that crossed inappropriately. So it's a very rare event. Now, we're going to know what happened. We're going to get a complete investigation that will do that will determine probable cause. And we're going to get factual information within the next 30 days in a preliminary report. All of these things will let us look and see if there are systemic issues, then they'll be addressed. Aviation is incredibly safe, and it has become that way partially due to understanding all the factors that lead up to an accident and doing everything we can to prevent a reoccurrence. And that will happen here.
Okay. Thank you both, John Cox and John Graddick, and of course, our condolences to the families of those pilots. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we are taking another break, and when we come back, we've spent so much time talking about Iran, talking about the Iranian diaspora and their hopes and dreams. I'm hoping to be able to talk about something a little positive, and that is the Iranian New Year, Nowruz, when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we've been spending a lot of time talking about Iran, the events inside Iran, the Iranian diaspora, and beyond the hope for the end of the radical Islamic regime, the news has been mostly bad. We had the slaughter of peaceful protesters in January, followed by the war that is on now. And some believe that after the assassination of the former supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, that the new leadership is even more extreme, radical, bloodthirsty, and desperate. So I was hoping to deal with something positive, and that is the Persian New Year Festival, Nowruz. It began on Friday. And here's something that really struck me. So the Globe and Mail had a photo spread, and we will include a link to it, under the headline of Tehran residents trying to find joy in this holiday, which is an ancient festival, marks the beginning of spring, people buy flowers. So the photos were taken at a bazaar, I believe it's called the Tajrish Bazaar. And what really struck me was not a single woman that I saw in these pictures was covered. They weren't wearing hijabs. They weren't wearing burqas. And not only were they not wearing these things, but they were willing to allow themselves to be photographed like that. And some of them even allowed the photojournalists to use their names. And I thought, wow, you know, this regime has killed women for letting their bangs slip out of a hijab. So I hope that this is significant, but I do not know. So let's go to Kaveh Sharuz, who is a lawyer, human rights activist, and senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute. Hello.
It's very good to be with you again, Libby.
Thank you. And let me try this. Let me try and say Happy Nowruz, which is Eid Shona Mubarak.
Eid Shona Mubarak. Thank you so much.
Okay. Okay, I'll have to practice that a little bit. what did you make of those photos? Is that in any way significant to you?
I think it is significant. I have seen images like that coming out of Iran in the last couple of years after the Woman, Life, Freedom uprising that occurred in 2022. After Mahsa Amini, your listeners and viewers might recall, Mahsa Amini, a young Kurdish Iranian woman, was killed because of improper hijab. And there was a mass uprising that really wanted to overthrow the regime. But really, it's sort of the core issue that ignited that was about women's rights. And since then, you know, the Iranian regime has a lot of problems on its hands. And what it's decided to do is to lower the enforcement of the hijab rules. Mm-hmm. And women have removed the hijab from their heads in such large numbers that insisting on it has become impractical for the regime. So this is really just an example. I mean, the laws haven't changed around the hijab. It's really important to remember. And the government can enforce those laws brutally if it wants to. But frankly, I think what you're seeing in Iranian society is women have just risen up and have just refused to go along with this gender apartheid rule anymore. I mean, this is one of many, many laws that are discriminatory towards women, but women have just decided to stop following this one.
Well, what makes me sort of scratch my head is that everything else that I've heard about the new leadership, and Israel has been assassinating some of the IRGC, which is supposedly in charge, was that they're more extreme. The son of Ali Khamenei, Mujtaba Khamenei, is apparently more extreme. And the IRGC is supposedly more brutal, and they're desperate because they're desperate. So this seems to be at odds with that.
Yeah, that's a fair observation. And I think it's very reasonable to expect that if you've got a more extremist or more religiously fundamentalist government in power, you would see more crackdowns on women. But in this case, though, I mean, I think the refusal to obey has been so widespread. And as I said, the regime has so many problems on so many fronts that they've just made, I think, a strategic and a tactical decision not to enforce the hijab rules anymore. And I think once you kind of let it go and allow women to come out in large numbers without the hijab, it becomes very, very difficult to put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. So I think this is one of those situations where women have just kind of taken power back despite what the regime wants. Remains to be seen. I mean, if this war ends and the regime kind of stays in power, odds are very good that they will clamp down very, very hard on any sort of dissent, including perhaps with respect to the hijab laws. But for the moment, there seems to be this slight opening that women have kind of, I don't want to give the regime any credit for it, but women themselves have obtained just through their sheer resistance.
So is this, I mean, it's very hard to get any kind of read on what's going inside because of the internet block, but is this more widespread than something for the Holiday Inn inside this particular bazaar? I mean, if you were to walk around, and you need to be brave, to walk around the streets of Tehran, would you be seeing this?
I think you would. A lot of the videos that I've been seeing in the past year, year and a half, coming out of various places in Iran, on you know, the videos I would see on social media, would have women, especially young women, walking around with their hair not covered. Now, of course, that differs from place to place. There are going to be cities and smaller towns, mostly, that are going to be more traditional, where the government has a stronger presence or tries to enforce the rules more strictly. But in a place like Tehran, which is the most sort of cosmopolitan and progressive place in Iran, I think it's fair to assume that women are no longer abiding by these rules.
Okay. I've seen assessments that, because the big hope, of course, was that when the war was launched, that it would lead to regime change. And some of the main actors seem to be backing off of that. And there have been assessments that if Iranians tried to protest the way they did in January, there would be more mass slaughter.
I think that is a fair assessment. I think that will occur if the war was to stop now. Now, if the war and the bombing campaign was to continue, perhaps it's hard to, put a certain amount of time on it. But if Iran's governmental tools of repression were to be sufficiently weakened, then I think, you know, people would come out. There would be some casualties, naturally, regrettably, but I think they would take power. But if the regime was to sort of be in the position that it is now, and as we speak, Donald Trump has said that he's not going to go through with his threats of bombing power plants and so on, because he's been in negotiations with Iran's regime. So it's fair to assume that there are negotiations happening, perhaps a ceasefire is in the works. If the regime was to be left standing with its current level of power, I think if people were to take to the streets, they would be slaughtered again in large numbers, unless there was to be a defection of the armed forces. At the moment, there's nothing to suggest that would be the case, but I think that's the calculation.
And so what's your take? It's hard to try to get a fix on who is lying, Donald Trump or the IRGC. He says that there are negotiations and he's putting a pause on his latest threat. And they say, no, we haven't talked to him.
Mm-hmm. This is one of those challenges of trying to report on a war where both sides are known for not exactly being truthful. Frankly, I think the Iranian regime recognizes that even though they've been able to resist for a while, and they've been able to cause some damage in the region, in the long term, they're going to militarily lose this war. So I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that behind the scenes, even though some of them are gesturing right now and saying no negotiation is taking place, that might be just for public consumption. Behind the scenes, I suspect that there's negotiations going on, that the Iranian regime has been willing to make certain concessions enough to satisfy Donald Trump, that hopefully for them, for the regime, this hostility will come to an end.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the population, so they're suffering because of this war. So are they, what's your read on how people feel about it and who they might be blaming?
Hard to say, because internet connection's been cut for so long. I don't have a sense of kind of the latest thinking among the public in Iran. Usually you kind of get a flavor of that on social media. But my sense is that at this moment still, the bombing campaign has been fairly precise. There have been a couple of incidents of mistakes where innocent civilians have been killed, and I don't want to downplay those. But by and large, Israel and the United States have been very precise in their attacks. So I don't think a lot of Iranians are still blaming them. I think they hold out hope that this will lead to regime change. But if Trump was to carry out on his threat from earlier in the weekend, where he was going to go after civilian infrastructure and knock out power supply, I think at that point you would begin to see the mood change, and people would hold Donald Trump responsible for the misery that they're experiencing at that point. I suspect at this point they still hold the regime responsible.
Okay, and in terms of the regime, we also saw on the weekend now, for Israel, getting rid of this capacity for even the ballistic missiles is one of the reasons for doing this. And we saw that these ballistic missiles on the weekend can go a lot farther than we thought.
Yeah, it looks like Iran can launch missiles that would go and hit various points in Europe. So I think that's all the more reason for the Western world to take this threat seriously. This is not a regional problem. This is Iran's problem, or the problems that Iran causes are not limited to its neighborhood. They're not limited to Israel. Iran, for a long time, activists have been saying, is an international problem. And I think now we're beginning to see that. And I think it's all the more reason to insist that Israel and the United States finish the job and topple this regime.
And what do you think the chances are that they finish the job? There's so much pressure, and local, I mean, Trump is losing popularity because of this. The allies are not in favor, even though they say they would join together to keep shipping the oil. But what do you think the chances are that this thing, gets finished?
Yeah, I mean, that changes hour by hour. But based on, things that Trump has been saying today about the negotiations, I think the chances of him toppling the regime at this point are pretty slim. This is the problem when you have a president who goes in without a clear set of objectives. So it was never entirely clear that this was about regime change. I suspect Israel is really keen on regime change. Whether or not they will prevail upon Donald Trump, I don't know, but it's not looking likely at the moment.
Uh-huh. So what is your prediction, say, just if we go week by week here, what are you expecting to unfold over the next week?
I suspect that you may begin to hear more and more about negotiations, first sort of behind the scenes, and perhaps then more explicit negotiations about terms of a potential ceasefire that will give Donald Trump an exit ramp from this conflict that has cost them a fair bit in terms of popularity domestically.
Okay. Now, I started by saying Happy Nowruz and trying to talk about something positive, and just to promote something that I'm going to put on social media. So if you'll forgive my mixing religious metaphors, the holy grail of Iranian cuisine for Nowruz is the rice with something called a tadig, which is a crispy bottom, which is very difficult. And I do cook. And I, when I thought all was lost, it was saved. My first tadig, we have some video. It will be online in the next day or so. So people watch out for that. And to all you Iranian Canadians or Americans out there, I'm happy to take pointers on how maybe to do it better next time. But it did come out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. Bye. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I'll be back here tomorrow. We'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.